Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2025, both adult and CYA categories. But we'll also be hearing from some other authors of historical fiction. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a staggering $155,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories and the Reader's Choice Award. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading and writing and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. Imagining the Past is commercial-free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation and can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. Elizabeth Storr's new novel, Fables of Lies, is set in World War II Germany, an historical setting and a story full of writing challenges. Fables and Lies deals with the wartime conservation of priceless artifacts. We delve into this treasure chest of a novel. Welcome, Elizabeth Storrs, to Imagining the Past.
Thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
So what were your first memories of reading and writing?
Well, I have to say Famous Five was my first memory of really getting into a book. But as I moved on, I actually then started getting interested in historical fiction right from the very beginning with Jean Plady.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Jean Plady and Rosemary Sutcliffe. I really love them. But I wasn't inspired to write historical fiction until I read Mary Rennett's The Persian Boy. And that just then really blew my mind and gave me the inspiration to start writing historical fiction.
So what, after school you went and did law, so I'm just wondering what the connection from the Famous Five to law was.
I don't know. certainly I didn't want to be solving mysteries. My original desire was to be a librarian, funnily enough. But then as time went on, I became interested in the law, mainly because I liked the whole courtroom drama type of thing. So I was interested in being a civil litigation lawyer. So that's how I ended up. And I also did arts and majored in English and history. And really, I think you'll find most lawyers, there is a frustrated author there or novelist.
Do you? I mean, I think law is an amazing degree. I wish I'd found out about it when I was young, but because I just think it's so rounded and general almost in a way. I mean, it obviously directs you towards a very specific type of thinking, but it just brings in so many things. And I think it equips you really well to just move through life generally. So what kind of stuff did you, you know, get out of law? What was it that really fired your imagination with that?
As I said, I enjoyed the courtroom. I really enjoyed that interaction, the presenting of a case and dealing with the personalities. I mean, having to come up against a judge, some of them were really scary, and you know, others were more reasonable. But just you had to be. I have this analytical side of my brain as well as the creative side. And so I really loved organizing cases, working out strengths and weaknesses of my opponents, and then having to be articulate and present that case in court. So that's really what I enjoyed. But as I moved up the ranks within a law firm, you end up not going to court. You end up being the mentor of junior solicitors who end up going to do most of the cases. So I then moved into being, this is very boring, but I moved into being a company secretary of NRMA, one of the company secretaries. And that was really amazing because there were fireworks going on in that board. And this is in the 80s and early 90s, and they were trying, half the board was trying to oust the other half of the board. I ended up being a witness in a huge court case about the failed float at NRMA. So I really learned a lot about observing human behavior from that and the dynamics of power. And that really, I think, has held me in good stead in developing characters.
Yeah, I think all of those things you've outlined of analysis and putting together a case and even just observing human beings when they're under, like in stressful situations, gives an author amazing insights into character and how people work and what kind of reactions they're going to have to things.
Definitely. I mean,
very Machiavellian stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I always think, I mean, I've had a pretty narrow life experience in terms of, in terms of my life. But being a lawyer and actually observing the boardroom it really gave me a lot of insight into how people think and act and the ethics.
Or ethicless. What were some of the first things that you actually started writing, and how did that come about that you started writing fiction?
Well, this sounds nuts, but I actually sat down and started writing. I stopped writing after university, which is short stories and things. And when I had my first child and took parental leave, that's when I started writing again. In between the sleep deprivation, I would sit down, and that's when I started actually writing the novel that became a bottom drawer novel and an inspiration for Fables and Lies, the World War II novel that I have just finished and released.
Right. So what you mentioned that you started reading historical fiction when you were quite young. What do you think writing historical fiction gives to your writing in terms of, how can I explain that? Does it bring a certain structure to the writing, or does it actually make you have to be incredibly more creative to actually work around history? What do you get out of writing historical fiction?
I am really fascinated with how you can look between the lines, read between the lines of history, and look at the emotions and look at the motives of people. And so history, to me, provides a scaffold, but the thing that fascinates me about historical fiction is actually trying to put yourself into those times, understand how a character might think, and also, bring an authentic world to a reader that they can immerse themselves in another time. Because I am myself, it is my escape. Like, it is my absolute pleasure and escape and passion, just disappearing into another world.
So have you written other things, even smaller things, that aren't historical fiction? Have you ever done that?
Well, this novel that I wrote, my first novel that I wrote, was a contemporary mystery novel that had had links to World War II, so I had kind of backflashes to World War II. But the novel itself was a contemporary novel. Perhaps I should explain what happened. I became fascinated with Heinrich Schliemann and his discovery of Priam's treasure at Troy. He was a larger-than-life character. And this amazing treasure ended up being stolen from a German museum at the end of World War II, and it disappeared. So I was writing it in the 90s, and this gold had disappeared and for 50 years, and the theory was it was lost in the chaos of war. So I came up with this mystery novel and about the Prime's treasure turning up in suburban Sydney. Lo and behold, in the 90s, the Russians during Glasnost finally admitted that they had the gold all that time, and it was sitting in the Pushkin Museum in Moscow.
Right.
So I put that away. It got put into the bottom drawer. It completely blew my mystery novel out of the water. And then I got obsessed with the Etruscans and Romans and wrote my Roman trilogy. And that kept me occupied for 10 years. And when that was finished, then I started to wonder what had happened in that 50 years and how the gold had come to be stolen from Berlin.
So what was it like going back to, you know, an idea that you had already worked on and had done quite a lot of research on, I would imagine, and starting again with that? Is there any bit of that novel that actually survived into Fables and Lies, or is Fables and Lies completely, you know, a new write?
Not a lot of it. I mean, there may have been imagery that I used, but the actual plot line I discovered, and what I had read in my local library, because that's all I had back in the 1990s, it was completely wrong. It was completely wrong. So 30 years later, researching historical fiction is just incredible, because you've got the internet, you've got library databases, academic journals. And what I discovered was that the Axis viewpoint suddenly was available, and I was able to read sources that told me what had happened during the World War II with Priam's treasure. And it was completely different. And what I'm glad now that I didn't publish my bottom drawer novel, because it was completely wrong, the history that I had discovered 30 years ago.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, because the first historical novel I wrote, which hasn't been published, but I got access to, I think it's Geoffrey Dutton's archive at the National Library, because he had done some research on the story, but he didn't end up writing it. So I got all of that, the dossiers that were in his archive, which did have some really interesting and some really helpful things in it. But he had in those documents, there was the plot outline that he was working on, and it was completely wrong. Like it was, and it just, and my research was in the late 90s, possibly. So, you know, the internet hadn't exploded at that point. So I had a bit more access to information. The information was coming from France, but nowhere near what I would have now. But he clearly had less, you know, and had really had to imagine this plot together. And I've always thought, you know, maybe that's why he didn't ever write the novel, because he knew, you know, he had these huge gaps that he'd filled in.
Yeah, well, as I said, I'm glad I didn't get to publish it, because it really has struck me that the Axis history for all that time, it kind of was taboo to look at it. Remarkably, there was a lot that wasn't known to the Western allied historians.
Yeah.
So the other thing is I now am able to access German sources, and luckily I had a very lovely friend who was an ex-German teacher, and she was prepared to translate them for me. And you're really getting at the coalface when you're able to read the German, either memoirs or the historians.
So like historically, your new novel, Fables and Lies, is a long way from A Tale of Ancient Rome, your A Tale of Ancient Rome trilogy. But once I'd kind of thought that, I started kind of wondering about it. And then, you know, are they really so disparate, those two stories, do you think? Sorry.
So the ancient Tale of Ancient Rome is based on a young treaty bride, a Roman treaty bride, who's married to an Etruscan nobleman to seal a truce. That those Etruscans and Romans were sworn enemies. And she's taken into his world, and she has to deal with conflicting moralities, because at that time, early Republican Rome was quite self-righteous and moralistic, and certainly with the women, and whereas the Etruscans were incredibly enlightened and granted sexual freedom and independence to women. So I was actually asked this question recently by Crystal King, who is another Roman writer in the States. And what I came to the conclusion, I actually made me have to think about it, was I like placing women characters under pressure in an environmental, in a pressure cooker environment, and they have to deal with conflicting moralities and ethical decisions, all the while being constrained in and how they can act out their choices. So Cecilia, my Roman woman, she's trapped in an enemy city, surrounded by people that she's been told were evil and debauched, and her eyes are opened to this new world, but she has to decide whether she's going to be faithful to Rome or faithful to her Etruscan husband and his people. Fables and Lies places a young German woman who's a museum assistant who is charged to assist in safeguarding antiquities, her nation's treasures, through World War II. She is raised in the Nazi dogma. She's indoctrinated. Her whole worldview places prehistory from a Germanic viewpoint. And her eyes are opened when a outsider comes in to this museum, Darian Lessing, and he is Cambridge educated, and he opens her eyes to the rot beneath the regime. So her story then becomes a story of enlightenment. But the pressure she's placed under is that she's forced to marry an SS ethnologist in order to protect her father. And she, in effect, has to become a faithful SS wife in order to escape danger herself, but also try and find out what her husband's research involves. So she is constantly dealing with moral choices of how much of her hand does she give to the devil before he takes it, and she loses all integrity to survive in this pressure cooker world of Nazi Germany.
Yeah, so both women are kind of in similar situations, even though they're like millennia apart. So, so was it hard after writing the three Roman novels to shift into this other time period? Just on a, you know, the nuts and bolts of writing stuff, how was that a difficult transition for you?
Incredibly difficult. the Roman Republic and Etruria, because it's truly in prehistory, there are very few primary sources. There's a lot of secondary sources that people think are primary, like Livy. So I was grappling with the lack of primary sources when I was dealing with early Republican Rome and the Etruscans. And then I hit World War II, and it was an avalanche. It was just an avalanche of all of these sources, and it was such a complex era. And in order to get my head around it, I actually researched World War I, because the impact of World War I and its aftermath on the Germans really affected how they ended up with voting in the Nazi Party and Hitler coming to power. And I wanted to understand the German psyche, and this book is very much from the German civilian's viewpoint. It's not about big battles. It's not about huge resistance stories. It's not a Holocaust story, although it does deal with the persecution and planned extermination of the Jews. And I just really struggled with having to sift through all the layers of information, and some of it was unreliable. I was reading memoirs and they had wacky kind of dates in it and things that definitely memories can be very fallible things. And so I had to work out a structure of how I was going to manage all of this, because my book covers 1939 to 1945. So I then discovered the true story of these German museum curators, and I was able to set up a timeline of how they were dealing with their safekeeping efforts. So that became like the spine in which I could then apply various episodes in Berlin and German history.
Yeah, you've talked about this a little bit with all the research that you've done, but I'm always interested how much the research then starts to inform the story, and then how much the story demands more kind of research. So how much you've mentioned there, you had a spine to your story before you started, but how much research have you done before you start writing, and what's the feedback from the story onto the research once you've got going?
Well, I will admit that I often fall into the tar pit of research. I tend to research first in order to get a broader idea of the era that I'm writing about. And then I will hone in on particular characters within, like historical characters, and research their background. And in my case, I was it started off as a basic story about a German woman trying to protect the prime's treasure, and then a Russian woman coming from the other side trying to plunder it in this, and they would meet in the siege of Berlin. Well, I ended up having something like that, but what I discovered was that the museum curator of the pre and early history museum was a Nazi himself and a member of Himmler's research institute. So that led me into a completely different plot. Actually, it became a much more complex plot because I wanted to also reveal the story of Himmler's master plan and how his scholars perverted history basically to serve power and ultimately justify conquest and dispossession and genocide. So it became a much wider book, and I then had to research more, but that's why it took me 8 years to research and write. But once I get into the writing, I'm a lawyer, ex-lawyer, sorry, I'm very structured. I I do have an outline. I do have a beginning and end that I do sometimes write my last sentence and then work towards it. I did that in two of my Roman books. So
Yeah,
sometimes
it's not actually a bad strategy to have
the
your
Thanks,
last
Greg.
chapter read or whatever. No, I've done that as well, when particularly when I've been struggling through the middle or something, and I've just thought, oh, this isn't working, I'll go and write the ending.
Yes. Well, yeah. Well, I do have a beginning and end, and that doesn't mean that my middle doesn't often shift. But I am quite structured, and
Yeah.
once I had the research underway, I felt confident. Then I started writing, and then sometimes little details would come in. I tend to write a draft and just put everything down on the page and then start hacking and what I call embroidering. So that's when you will look for some details that will, bring the story to life.
Yeah, the novels are, all of your novels are, from my perspective anyway, quite long. They're much longer than things I've been able to do. So I'm just wondering about some of the logistics of that, because it is, I mean, well, you've just said it took you 8 years to write, research and write it. But, at what level do you start having to kind of pare back stuff? Because, I think we all grapple with the big problem of getting the historical fact into the prose in a leavened and kind of nice manner without just an information dump. So at what point of your writing do you start kind of like taking stuff out that possibly you thought was really necessary, but in as the things come together isn't so necessary?
Well, one of the points is when you tell me to, Greg. Greg's
Most
in my writing
frequently said
group.
thing by Greg, cut
Yeah,
it.
Greg's in my writing group, and writing groups are very, very valuable, both in support but also in feedback. And when my writing group starts saying, "Well, I think that's sounding like a history lesson," that's when I needed to start really examining it. And I have a I once when I first started writing, I went to a lecture by Robert McKee, who's a famous American screenwriter. And what was interesting about him is that he said that every single shot on a film, a beat, should be relevant, and you don't have any extraneous camera shots. It should always move, forward the plot of the movie. And I kind of took that on board. And to me, I try and write in beats so that everything I put in finally in a chapter has to either drive plot, instill a sense of place, deepen the character, or bring out the greater theme. So it's a good way, it's a good lens to go back in your writing and see whether my love of putting in historical detail actually didn't achieve any of those purposes.
Yeah, I think that's a really great image because I've always tried to imagine, not that I write with a pen, but it's kind of like the tip of my pen is the camera lens that I'm
Yeah.
looking at the scene through. And it's true when you watch a movie, it's too glib to just think, the most casual glance of the camera has not been constructed right down to the objects that are on the desk or anything like that. And all of those things, hopefully, if the movie's working well, are adding to what the director wants you to take away from it. I think that's a really good a good image. Like when you first gave me the manuscript of Fables and Lies, what I found kind of immediately interesting and intriguing about it was that we were on the other side of the coin in Berlin, during the Third Reich. Like you must have had to ride some pretty fine lines to do that, I think, to make a character attractive to readers and yet embed them in something that's we have been told is a was ab abhorrent. So what kind of strategies did you use to kind of to do those kind of almost contradictory things to make her agreeable, but she's in a very disagreeable situation.
Well, the one thing I really impacted me when I was doing my research was just how deeply indoctrinated the youth was. The Nazis sacked the teachers. They only employed Nazi teachers. All of the curriculum was changed to pretty basic stuff and heavily weighted towards physical exercise. And the aim was to make soldiers out of the boys and mothers and wives out of the women, out of the girls. And they really inculcated them with Nazi dogma and my case, what I was interested in was the perversion of prehistory to justify that they were the master race under the Aryan myth, and then they could, they were the master race, they were the leaders of the world, and the children, it was very seductive for them to be told that. So I have Freya raised in that world, but in order to try and give her the reader some empathy for her, I looked at her backstory very carefully. I looked at when she was born and what she would have gone through before the Nazis came into power. So she's 21 at the start of the novel, and that means she would have been in a cohort that would have had some liberal education before the Nazis came in. In her teenage, impressionable teenage years, she does come under that dogma. But before that, she has a grandmother that gives her access to a library that has books including H.G. Wells, for example, and Jack London. And so she's had a bit of a taste of what it was like, and she's watched the book burnings. And she's also got a father who is a very devout Christian with a strong moral compass that she sees is rejecting Nazi doctrine. So the thing with the Nazi teachers, they encourage children to inform on any of their parents that had anti-fascist views. Freya, She's intelligent enough to be concerned that her life is very limited in what she wants to be an archaeologist, in fact, and she will never be able to do that under the Nazi regime. And she is prepared, I think, as a result, to have a little chink there where she starts to, appreciate the fact that there are the regime is oppressive. And also when Darian Lesson comes in, he is the window to the world. He who is suddenly he has been in England, he can come back, tell her what the rest of the world knows, and that is Germany is an aggressor. Tell her that the viewpoint of Germanic history isn't all German centric. She starts to respond to that. And I think the aim of this novel is to trace her journey to enlightenment. But she's always got these moral conflicts. She's surrounded by a family with very different views.
Yeah,
because
I think
mother and her daughter, mother and her sister are pro-Nazi.
Yeah, but I think the thing that I liked about her really, really early on in the novel was her. Her empathy. She was empathetic with people who, were poorer or, could see other people's situations and empathize with them, which meant for me there was this flicker of something already alight in her very early on in the novel, which, obviously the flame grew. That's the path of the novel. That was the promise of the novel, that that flame would grow in her. All of your works have occurred in foreign languages. The Etruscan language is largely unknown, I think, and you obviously use German in this. So what kind of decisions did you have to make about rendering these situations that you've written about in, you know, largely modern English? That's quite a thing to do.
Well, the Etruscans are often called mysterious because their literature was destroyed by the Romans and Greeks who conquered them. So, you know, victors write the history. Very little of their script remains, but more and more is being discovered archaeologically about them. A lot of what inspired me was their tomb art. They've got spectacular frescoes that reflect what their life was like.
Just going back to the actual language, they still don't know, or they've still got things they've not been able to translate, don't they?
Well, that's right. I mean, the problem is that they did have a kind of a Rosetta Stone that they found, which were called the Pergi tablets that translated Etruscan with Phoenician. But the trouble is all we've got is like scraps of inscriptions to the gods, or they don't have a canon of literature that you can then apply that Rosetta Stone kind of moment to. So there just isn't, it was destroyed. So what we do have from them is actually religious texts that are to do with their ability to foresee the future. So but that was recorded by later Roman and Greek historians. So in terms of the Roman and Etruscan like language, I tried to, you know, I think now with historical fiction, we can't be true. We can never be true to how the language in any era really might be heard. I made my writing much more formal. I didn't use contractions, for example. So the language I used was probably a more formal flavor to so that and not using slang, for example.
Old jargon.
So that's how I kind of approach writing from the ancient world. With the German, what I did, and again, thanks to you telling me that I'm writing a book in English and not German, I did put down as or when I first wrote it, I put down everything with the German names. There was a lot of Nazi terminology and conceptual language, and I used that. But with subsequent drafts, I then looked at basically translating it all into the equivalent English terms, but I do have a smattering.
Yeah, there are, and you've got problems too, haven't you, with the rankings of the German system, army system, don't correspond directly to ours. I think like they've got different. So I think you did use the titles for the officers.
Yeah, well, it was a different ranking system within the German army, the Wehrmacht and the SS. So, I sometimes would say equivalent, you know, like say our captain or major, but they had different storm leaders, etc. So it didn't actually translate correctly, even within the German context. Mm. So that's why I use the SS titles in that respect.
Oh, it's complicated, isn't it? When you use dates and date ranges at the beginning of your chapters, which I really appreciate because I think it kind of really helps the reader to orientate themselves and keep themselves orientated. A lot of writers don't do that. But what were some of your decisions around doing that, of having those dates explicitly put in the chapter headings?
Well, again, that comes down to really using the diary notes and the history of what was happening in the museum. So I was really working out what was happening because amazingly I was able to get the day journals of the Wilhelm Unversehrte was the Nazi curator that, you know, risked his life and did amazing things to save all of his exhibits. There were
goodness, that's
100,000.
That was a gift.
Pardon?
That was a gift to get
it
that.
Was, and it was. And I also was given his wife. He married after the war, and his wife wrote this extensive article about what happened in the museum. And it actually, all of those museum kind of happenings, I could then track to what was happening around them in Berlin. So it was kind of this skeleton that I could then look at sources to see what was happening to the everyday German in that week of August, or in New Year's Eve, so on, you know, whatever date. And that's how I kind of pinned it to the world outside. But I only allude to the battles that are happening, or I only give very brief references to what's happening in the wider battle front. So I just, it helped me as well to, you know, always set a date.
Yeah. No, I just think it's so helpful. But as I said, I think a lot of writers don't put those things in, which it just is another. Well, you know, another thing the reader has to kind of really keep up with. So I think it's worth, authors should care for their readers as much as possible. Just going back to your Roman trilogy, like, they were three books, and as I've said, three fairly large books, and they were written over a long period of time. So I'm just, and they're all standalone novels. So that must have been really hard to do. I'm just wondering a bit about that. How did you plan all that, or how did all of that come together?
Well, the Wedding Shroud is the first book, and that similarly took me about 8 years to write and 10 to finally get published. But that was written, you know, in between my day job and looking after kids and aging parents, so it did take a long time. But in fact, I was given a contract to write The Golden Dice, the second book, at the same time as writing The Wedding Shroud. And I wrote that in 18 months. So I had figured out, oh, I've cracked this. I know how to write a novel. Subsequently, that deal fell through when the publisher's fiction imprint folded. And I ended up self-publishing The Wedding Shroud and The Golden Dice because I was determined not to let these books that had taken so much time and my passion just disappear into the ether. And self-publishing at that time in 2012, it was taking off. It was called the Indie Gold Rush. And Amazon was providing you with great opportunities to raise your profile within the marketplace. And as a result, I was then picked up by one of Amazon Publishing's own imprints called Lake Union Publishing. And they commissioned me to write Call to Juno, which I did in 12 months. So, you know, I definitely got more efficient. But in each instance, I went from one protagonist to three in The Golden Dice, and then four in Call to Juno. So I was constantly expanding and having to research different characters, what they would have gone through. So I figured out how to write a Roman novel. But then I hit World War II, and I was back to square one.
Yeah, well, I think that's good for an author to start again with a different set of things. So, what do you see Fables and Lies offering the modern world and the modern times that we live in?
Well, I think It is a novel for our times because we're going into German civilians and how they coped with the Third Reich. And it's a deep dive into the Nazi psyche. Your reader will learn a lot that they have never known about, or they might have heard of the Aryan myth or the master race, but I will be able to explain how that Aryan myth arose. So they'll learn about the expedition to Tibet to find the survivors, evidence of survivors of Atlantis. They'll learn about how the Germans then claimed that the Indo-Aryan race or Indo-European race arose in the north and spread across Europe, and therefore they were entitled to take back ancestral lands. They'll learn about the very vicious and heinous racial studies, which underpinned the negative and positive eugenics. And there's a lot of unknown hidden histories that I think will enlighten them as to what the predicament was of Germans, because we often try and look at them as a monolith, that they must have all been bad, that, you know, why didn't the good people do something? And the world that I create will show the reader that it's pretty frighteningly like what's happening in America today.
Yeah,
so,
that's
there is complacency, there's culpability, and there's complicity on various levels, which is what I discovered. I think what's happened in America, we've seen how civil liberties and institutions have been undermined or destroyed in rapid pace. Like, it's just an onslaught of change, which I think for many, many good people, they're just overwhelmed. And then they become fearful too, because they start to see that retribution is occurring. And certainly in Nazi Germany, it started to be death sentences for even listening to foreign radio or reading foreign books. And so journalists became enemies of the state. Intellectuals were sent to concentration camps, where immigrants are seen as, the dreaded replacement theory, where they're destroying culture and overbreeding. All of the things that we are actually starting to see is destroying a democracy, is what you will learn happened to the German people in Fables of Nights.
Yeah, I think that's true. As your projects evolved, you know, it's almost like it has evolved again around us. So it has provided some insights into that for me. What are you working on now, and will it be a standalone as well?
Well, the aim, it is a standalone. I try and write all my books, even though that trilogy is, you can read them as standalones. But it is a companion novel to Fables and Lies. So I'm going back to the bottom drawer novel concept, as in what happened to that, you know, what happened to that gold for 50 years? What did the Russians do with it? So I'm inspired by Geraldine Brooks' People of the Book, and I'm creating a novel which takes the reader from the Bronze Age goldsmith who created the jewels, and then Sophia Schliemann, who is the wife of Heinrich Schliemann, who was involved with the dig at Troy, when they found that amazing cache. And then it deals with the Soviet Trophy Brigade major who came through and stole the gold from Berlin and ended up being a curator at the Pushkin Museum, hiding it. And in between, I have a Freya's granddaughter in the 1990s, and she's piecing together all of these bits of history. And
well, we'll look forward to reading that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to finishing it.
That's the rub, isn't it? Well, thank you very much for your time today. It's been a really broad conversation we've had, and I've enjoyed it.
Oh, so have I. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. Please remember to explore our extensive podcast archive, where you'll find a wealth of interviews. I'm Greg Johnston. Keep reading, keep listening. It's so good to have your company, Imagining the Past.